Within hours of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, numerous political prisoners across the country were rounded up and thrown in administrative detention.
There's been a number of indicators over the last couple of weeks that the United States was looking at conducting some sort of military operations in Sudan.
Nigeria is a very wealthy country in some senses. It's accrued over $300 billion in oil revenues over 25 years. And yet, over 70% of Nigerians live on less than $1 a day.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, July 10th. 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. American troops may still be in Iraq 4 years from now, General Tommy Franks told Congress today. The wartime commander told the House Armed Services Committee, "I anticipate we'll be involved in Iraq in the future. Whether that means 2 years or 4 years, I don't know." There are nearly 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, some of them under fire from anti-U.S. forces. Frank said we need to not develop an expectation that all of these difficulties will go away in 1 month or 2 months or 3 months, he testified. The general said the troop strength would be held at the current level at least through the end of the year. Pleading for patience, President Bush said the United States would have to remain tough in Iraq despite attacks on U.S. soldiers that killed at least four more Americans today. Bush spoke in Gaborone, Botswana, amid a debate at home about erroneous evidence that the administration cited as part of its justification for the invasion of Iraq. Senator John Kerry, a Democrat from Massachusetts who is running for president, said the United States does not have sufficient forces to reconstruct Iraq without support from other nations. He said, quote, "We now know that the administration went to war without a thorough plan to win the peace. It is time to face that truth and change course to share the post-war burden internationally for the sake of our country, for our standing in the world, and most of all for the young Americans in uniform who cannot be protected from an enemy attack by an announcement, no matter how well staged, that hostilities are over." With daily shootings and rocket attacks against U.S. soldiers claiming four more lives, even Iraqi policemen said today they want to keep a safe distance from coalition troops for fear of getting caught in the crossfire. Several dozen Iraqi police, most wearing new uniforms provided by the U.S. military, marched on the mayor's office in Fallujah, a restive town west of Baghdad, insisting American soldiers stop using their station as a base. The Iraqis said they would quit their posts if the soldiers don't find a new home within 48 hours. President Bush, meanwhile, continues his five-day tour of Africa, stopping off today in Gaborone, Botswana. Rising anti-American sentiment fueled by discontent over the U.S.-led war in Iraq cast a shadow over President Bush's visit to South Africa earlier this week. Scores of disgruntled South Africans have protested this week outside the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria and the consulates in Johannesburg and Cape Town. Secretary of State Colin Powell held a press conference in Pretoria today and responded to questions from the press corps. Liberia, the troubled African nation plagued by rebel insurgency to oust President Charles Taylor, was an issue that dominated the discussion. Powell was asked whether the U.S. would be sending peacekeeping troops to Liberia to ensure the departure of President Taylor, who has been granted asylum in the West African country of Nigeria.
The president's examining all of his options with respect to how we can assist in the transfer of power in Monrovia as President Taylor leaves. President Taylor has reaffirmed that he is prepared to leave the country upon the arrival of peacekeepers. I just got off the phone with Kofi Annan to review the current state of play. Our assessment team in Monrovia has about finished its work, and I expect that we'll be getting a full report from them on the humanitarian situation in Monrovia. And this weekend in Accra, Ghana, a U.S. team will be meeting with the ECOWAS military leaders to assess what will be required to move the ECOWAS troops into Monrovia and to support them. And as part of that assessment, what role the United States might play or ECOWAS thinks we should play. The president hasn't made any specific decisions on the level of support or actual participation, boots on the ground, combat units is the essence of your question. And I expect that over the next several days, as we finish the assessment in Monrovia and get that report, and the military assessment team working with ECOWAS over the weekend, the president will be in a position to make a decision. Yes.
Just to follow on Liberia, since there's growing pressure for something to happen, is it your expectation that the African troops would go in first if Taylor's awaiting a peacekeeping force, their closest they could get in there more quickly and Taylor could exit the scene? Do you expect that to be the way things play out? They'd go in first and the U.S. role would be fine-tuned later? And I have one follow-up.
I don't want to get too deeply into how it might be synchronized. I think the preference would be for Mr. Taylor to leave at about the time that an ECOWAS force is arriving. The arrival of the ECOWAS force would have to be facilitated and supported in some way by the United States, whether that is just with logistics units or command and control units or communications facilities of that or support of that kind, or whether there would actually be U.S. troops on the ground. The intention right now is to lead with ECOWAS, and Secretary General has been quite clear about that. The preference is to lead with ECOWAS, with the U.S. essentially playing a role of support, and if it's participation, then we'll make a judgment as to what the level of that participation is. But the chronology is or the synchronization and chronology in terms of who arrives on what day, that's all going to be worked out in the days ahead.
To just follow, in the international community and some folks at home view Liberia not just as potentially a domestic political issue for this White House, but as an international one, that despite the president's rhetoric on nation building here after Iraq, after so many frayed relations, that the international community reached out to us, this is a unique country, that this is a chance for all those things to come together and for the president to send a political message through Liberia. Do you think that there is a message being delivered here?
The international, the international community very often looks to the United States for economic assistance, for political support, and for military support. This is a situation where I'm pleased that the United Nations and ECOWAS, that part of the international community, has made it clear that they have responsibility for the political transformation, the provisional arrangements that will be made, and that will lead, we hope, to a new election after the departure of President Taylor. And the UN has made it clear that they have principal responsibility for the humanitarian relief effort and the reconstruction effort, the nation-building part of this. And so this is a case where there is, it seems to me, going to be an appropriate division of responsibility and activity with the United Nations and ECOWAS, in other words, the region, working through the United Nations, doing the political transformation, doing the nation building, and providing for the humanitarian support. And the United States lending its good offices and some level of support and participation as appropriate, but letting others take the lead in the long-term work. If there is U.S. participation, particularly on the ground, we fully expect and have made it clear to our friends in the international community, ECOWAS and the UN, that we see it as being very limited in duration and scope, and really for the purpose of getting ECOWAS in there in sufficient strength to do the long-term rebuilding effort, stabilization effort, and if, as it becomes appropriate in due course, to put the blue helmets on and be the peacekeeping force for the longer term.
Secretary of State Colin Powell fielding questions at a press conference in Pretoria, South Africa. President Bush pledged to the nation with the world's highest AIDS infection rate that it will have a strong partner in his administration in fighting that disease. He said, quote, "You will not face this enemy alone." Bush's remarks were greeted with chants of Pula Pula, which means all good things in Botswana. But even as he was delivering the pledge, his $15 billion five-year AIDS program was being cut back in Congress. as the world contemplated Bush's epiphany without apology on the subject of slavery during his brief visit to the Senegalese coast, Peace Watch producer Robert Knight discovered that Bush neglected to mention his own family's involvement with slavery. In a report earlier today on WBAI's Wake Up Call, Knight recounted the ownership in 1860 of 16 slaves in Hannibal, Missouri, by the family of Nancy Holliday, Bush's great-great-grandmother. In addition, Knight traced Bush family patriarch Hendrik Bosch, a Danish arms maker who immigrated to New York, and whose heirs later moved northeast to Greenwich, Connecticut, anglicizing the surname to Bush. There, according to records of the first U.S. Census of 1790, there were enumerated 4 Bush households owning a combined total of 13 slaves. The White House had no response to Knight's repeated inquiries about the Bush family's apparent historical involvement with slavery. Meanwhile, Bush left Senegal earlier this week, continuing his African sojourn, en route to Uganda by way of Botswana. After a controversial visit to South Africa, Peace Watch correspondent Robert Knight has more.
George Bush's visit to South Africa was met with protest and disagreement in the streets and halls of government Wednesday. Bush refused to meet with apartheid liberator and former President Nelson Mandela, who himself referred to Bush as a leader who, quote, cannot think properly, end quote. In Mandela's absence, Bush was met with thousands of angry protesters in Pretoria who carried signs saying, go away, we have enough Bushes in Africa. Bush's reception was no warmer with current President Thabo Mbeki, who is resisting his call to help remove Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe from office. South Africa's anti-war coalition also marched on the U.S. embassy to deliver a memorandum demanding a people's tribunal against Bush and warmongers in Iraq and stating, quote, it is clear that Bush has now set his sights on Africa's oil and the people should prepare for the possibility of U.S. invasions in Africa, end quote. That may well come to pass in Africa's largest nation as Bush pursues a petrocentric foreign policy in Iraq and now possibly Sudan, whose oil reserves are just beginning to be tapped. Sudanese oil is a key motivation for Bush's visit to Uganda later this week, and so is a military operation, according to Jamie Etheridge, an Africa policy analyst for Stratfor, the strategic forecasting think tank.
There's been a number of indicators over the last couple of weeks that the United States was looking at conducting some sort of military operation in Sudan, possibly a counter-terrorist operation. There's been increased training activity in Djibouti, and Stratfor.com has heard from sources in the Pentagon that the U.S. military was planning an operation in Sudan. So the relationship between the United States and Sudan is not severed. It's not even, at this point, hostile. It's wary. Khartoum wants to work together. At the same time, it's a regime that's had problems with the United States in the past, is still under U.S. sanctions, and is not just going to roll over. And the United States wants full and complete cooperation without any questions asked.
With Ugandan cooperation, the United States is maintaining a southern front of insurgency and potential partitioning of Sudan, which is at odds with the interests of Egypt along Sudan's northern border.
Egypt looks at Sudan as its sphere of influence, one. Secondly, the unity of Sudan is vital to Egyptian interests because of the Nile, which comes up through Sudan, and both parts of the Nile, the white and the blue, come through Sudan. The dissolution or the Balkanization of Sudan and a separate state in the south controlled by Christian animist groups would reduce Egypt's influence in Sudan and over the resources of the Nile. And it would give other countries, like Uganda, for instance, more sway. The United States has long looked at supporting the rebels in the south as a means of pressuring Khartoum, whereas for Egypt, the rebels in the south pose a threat to their long-term interest in controlling Sudan.
Just as the Reagan administration used proxies along Nicaragua's border during the Contra Wars, the Bush administration has forged alliances across the Ugandan border with rebels of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army.
For almost 2 decades, there is a group in the south, they're largely Christian animist, that has opposed control by the Arab Muslim government in Khartoum and has fought a civil war against that. The United States has long used its relationship with Uganda as a pressure point against the northern government and by indirectly and sort of tacitly politically supporting the southern rebels. In addition, there's dozens of U.S. charities and religious foundations that provide humanitarian aid, and to the Southern rebels, which the Southern rebels have used to continue their war against the North.
The ultimate motivation for the United States' potential destabilization of Sudan is, of course, the petrocentricity of Bush's foreign policy.
Sudan's oil industry is still in the early stages of development. It's only been since the mid-90s. It does have substantial reserves, but not comparable to even Nigeria. Because of the sanctions, no American company can invest in the oil industry. Sudan, as an oil producer, could be interesting in the long term. In the short to midterm, it's more an interest of military and security.
Would the complexion of what you've just described change if there were an autonomous zone created in the south?
It's very possible, yes, because most of the oil that has been discovered so far anyway is located in the south. So if that region were to become autonomous from the north and gain control over the exploration and exploitation of the oil reserves, then certainly the calculus would change.
Jamie Etheridge is a policy analyst with Stratfor, the strategic forecasting think tank. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Peace Watch.
Well, as Bush travels around Africa, the world spotlight is suddenly falling on a part of the world that generally receives little coverage in the American media. With the civil war in Liberia looming in the background, Bush has pledged to deliver $15 billion to combat AIDS and spur economic growth on the African continent. Among Africa's most valuable assets is oil, and it's been estimated that as much as 20 to 25% of U.S. oil imports will likely come from West Africa by the year 2005. One of the main oil producers and also Africa's most populous country is Nigeria. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Daphne Wysham, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, about Nigeria's strategic importance to the U.S. and the U.S.'s plan to send troops to protect its oil interest in the region.
Ever since September 11th, and even before, beginning back in the 1970s in the first OPEC oil crisis, but certainly with more urgency since September 11th, the Bush administration has been turning its attention to regions of the world where oil can be extracted that are not in the grips of what they consider fundamentalist regimes, such as in Iran or Saudi Arabia, or now that we've toppled the regime of Saddam Hussein, we can certainly plan on getting more oil from that region. But right now what the U.S. is pushing for is to open up oil and gas reserves in West Africa and accelerate the export of crude from Nigeria from about 14% today to about 25% of imports to the United States by 2015. This is based on information that we're getting from various studies that are coming out of the UK and out of think tanks in this country and elsewhere. But, of course, a lot depends on Nigeria's willingness to go along with this agenda, and in particular the willingness of the people of the Niger Delta to go along with this agenda. And as you probably know, Nigeria is a very wealthy country in some senses. It's accrued over $300 billion in oil revenues over 25 years of oil extraction, and yet over 70% of Nigerians live on less than a dollar a day. And there was this recent price hike in fuel prices of over 50% that resulted in a general strike that was declared for 8 days. Most of Nigeria was just totally shut down. And the biggest irony here is that here's a country that is producing oil for global markets and has virtually no refining done on its own land, and so must pay exorbitant prices for energy, and at a time when people are making less than a dollar a day, when you have a 50% price hike in fuel, this has reverberations throughout the economy. And so Nigeria is teetering on the verge of some serious turmoil internally. And in the Delta, where most of this oil is extracted, you have the most entrenched poverty. There is the equivalent of 10 times the Exxon Valdez oil spill in the Niger Delta that has never been cleaned up. And keep in mind, the Exxon Valdez oil spill cost about $10 billion to clean up, and it's still causing problems in Alaska. So imagine $100 billion worth of cleanup effort that would be required to clean the delta to a point where fish could flourish and farming could once again be the staple for the hundreds of thousands of people that make their home there.
So are you saying basically that Nigeria is prime to cooperate with the U.S. In terms of being willing to sell its oil reserves?
Well, right now what we have in Nigeria is what my friends in Nigeria call a dictatorial democracy. Yes, we've had so-called democratic elections, although the elections that resulted in Obasanjo being placed in power had very questionable voter turnout of over 100% in some areas. You know, so there's sort of a wink and a nod, and he's allowed to assume the presidency again, but not without a lot of protests in the Niger Delta in particular. So Obasanjo will go along with this agenda that's coming out of the White House, very likely, and the agenda being not only to ramp up the export of crude to U.S. markets and Western markets, but also to go along with the deployment of U.S. troops. This is sort of a little noticed article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal in mid-June that pointed out that the Pentagon is planning on shifting troops from Germany to two key regions of the world where we are interested in the oil resources, namely West Africa and the Caspian. And and the article quoted U.S. government officials as saying that one of the primary focuses of these troops in West Africa will be to secure Nigerian oil. And I don't know if you recall the protests that occurred last year with the women taking over the oil platforms and protesting. This was an act of desperation. The women had seen their husbands, their sons, their fathers beaten, tortured, killed whenever they tried to protest not only the environmental degradation that's taken place as a result of you know, 40 years mm-hmm. of oil exploration, but the human rights abuses that are common, the so-called kill and go, the police that come in and shoot first and ask questions later. Under Obasanjo, over 10,000 people have been killed in conflicts, and largely in the Niger Delta at the hands of the military police just in the last 2 years. And so the women decided that their men were going to get brutalized, but perhaps if they took a stand, the military would be more reluctant, and the kill and go would be more reluctant to take them on.
And were they more reluctant?
They were, and they were because the media would be very difficult to convince that the women were violent, because that's one thing, you know, it's difficult to get accurate information out of the Delta, and too often the information that we get is that there are these violent youths and violent this, violent that, and so there's somehow it's excusable to send in the military. Mm-hmm. But when you have hundreds of women taking over oil platforms, it's hard to imagine that they could overwhelm the oil workers with violence. And so and they made it very clear that they were unarmed, that their only weapon was their nakedness. They were going to threaten to disrobe completely, which in Nigeria is an act of great shaming. If a woman publicly disrobes, you're shaming the people that she's doing it in front of. And so they were threatening to do this to these big oil companies and brought them to a total standstill. And the point of their protest was that here this enormous wealth is being extracted from underneath their earth and their waters, and their people are seeing no trace of the profits mm-hmm. and are only suffering these enormous costs.
What were the oil companies involved in that? Is that Shell?
Shell, Chevron Texaco is a big exporter from the Delta, ExxonMobil, but Shell is number one.
So when you say that you have a dictatorial democracy in power there in Nigeria, and we see where the Pentagon is positioning over 5,000 troops to be moved, transported from Germany over to Nigeria, are we assuming that that Obasanjo, President Obasanjo of Nigeria, has not given permission, and or that despite the fact that he has given permission, he is a dictatorial leader, and that there's opposition from the people is expected, a rebel insurgency?
Well, there's already, first of all, that the troops would probably not be stationed in Nigeria itself. They would be stationed in Ghana, in other countries throughout Africa, in Mali, Senegal, Algeria, Kenya, Morocco, Tunisia. These are the countries that have been pointed out as possibly being homes to these bases. But they would be capable of moving rapidly to secure Nigeria's oil if required. But also, certainly the agenda of the Bush administration is one of trying to put down any sort of quote-unquote terrorist efforts in different parts of Africa.
So we can expect to see this couched as terrorist efforts?
Anti-terrorist,
and to sort of veil the fact that it's really to protect the so-called U.S. oil interest.
Exactly. Yeah,
in Nigeria.
Yeah, clearly oil is a U.S. interest, isn't it? Certainly is a key interest in Iraq, and it's increasingly a key interest in other parts of the world. As you know, our domestic supply is not enough to supply our constant thirst for oil.
It seems like that word U.S. interest has a double meaning. I kind of initially thought when they said that it would be facilities that are already in place that have been established there, you know, to protect those interests. But now it seems to mean anywhere the U.S. is interested in going and acquiring something.
Right. Well, it's interesting to look back and take note of an agenda that was actually put forward in 92 by Wolfowitz, who basically said, We need to reposition our military globally to prevent the hostile takeover of key resources and thereby key U.S. interests overseas.
Mm-hmm.
He also urged the preemptive strikes against countries that possess weapons of mass destruction, which is, of course, what we've just done. We haven't proven weapons of mass destruction, but we certainly had the preemptive strike in
mm-hmm.
Iraq. So you can see this agenda slowly being carried out over the last the first Bush administration, and now the second Bush administration is being even more aggressive in pushing this agenda.
And so what long-term ramifications do you think placing such a large contingent of U.S. troops in Africa will have on the political climate in the region and on U.S.-African relations?
Well, I think it's a very short-sighted policy. It will have potentially a very explosive impact on the frustrations that people already feel with regard to their own military oppressing their right to peaceful dissent and protest. And Nigeria has yet to create a constitution of, by, and for the people. There are still these draconian laws that are in place that were put in place by dictators like Abacha and his predecessors. So our bringing in our military to back up the Nigerian kill and go and other Nigerian troops is really sending the exact opposite message to Nigeria than what we should be sending, which is we want to strengthen their own democracy. And ultimately what we should be doing, and of course that won't happen under the Bush administration, but we should be encouraging them to diversify their economy, because time and again, countries that rely virtually exclusively on oil to develop become corrupt, They become anti-democratic regimes and ultimately can foster the sort of terrorism and terrorist activities that we're seeing in other parts of the Middle East.
You said earlier that there are about 70% of the Nigerians are earning less than a dollar a day.
That's right. That's right.
And this is one of the oil-richest countries in the world?
And it's the most populous country in Africa, and a lot of countries, a lot of people are coming to Nigeria because they perceive it to be a wealthy country. But, of course, the wealth is held in the hands of those few that have political connections and connections to these big corporations, and the remainder of the Nigerians live in abject poverty.
Daphne Wysham, a fellow at the Washington-based Institute for Policy Studies, will have more of our discussion with her tomorrow. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in 60 seconds.